That's right, right. So the technocracy, but he's saying that the average, well, is he saying, is it just if you're going to get to an elitist position, you've got to have a PhD? Now, Hugh Kenner says that he always praised McLuhan for telling him in the 40s he's got to get a PhD. See, these are old ideas. This is the explorations ideas. The fact that he's trying to be detached about the McLuhan that was indicate there's a new McLuhan afoot here.
Well, if that holds, then he's going to set it up and he's going to deliver it in the second half of this article.
All right. No matter what the area study be, so it be done in depth. That is the vision of American business and education today for good ill. Now, maybe he doesn't mean this is a depth criticism is what happens in the elementary schools, but he's saying this is what happens in corporations. But he does say that every 10 element, that means 1 out of 10 goes to the PhD, right? To be part of the technocracy,
yep.
Technocratic elite. Okay, so that's the only role for literacy. Okay, so he's saying that the literate people, if they're going to have any role in the future, it's going to be in the ivory tower of hardware management, not the control tower, the ivory tower. The hardware technocratic elite goes into the ivory tower. He says in Gutenberg Galaxy, Big Brother goes inside, right? Those are the... whereas the artist goes into the control tower, which is media management, which is actually being done by the White House. It does the word, orchestrates very carefully what its word is in responding to any particular situation. And even then, it's a stress to get it right. Okay. On all hands today, it is plain that actualities are much in advance of our thought. Oh, here's what you predicted. He's talking about actualities, right? Are much in advance of our thought and theory. When everything changes at once because everything has become interdependent, we can expect from the very heart of change a plangent cry for permanence and stability. In other words, he's saying from the artists and scientists who are trying to change the world, they become neoconservative and cry for permanent instability. And that is the prediction of the Gaia movement, the ecological movement. And that's what he's going to say when he quotes a little kid.
Yeah, this so a buttressing, I guess, because we've had the Minerva moment and we're now trying to buttress permanence and stability.
Very good. Yeah, this is buttressing the human chemical body and some of its more mechanical institutions. Now, this poem, "The Stars Are So Big, The Moon Is So Small, Stay As You Are," that's cited in Understanding Media, but we never knew where it came from. But here he gives the background to it. A second grade teacher, just after Sputnik, asked her class to write poems about the event. She was quite amazed at the results and showed them to me. See? Somebody in Toronto, probably. Or some teacher on his lecture circuit. The point is, I always wondered where he got this poem from a little kid. Who did it, right? Well, it's a teacher he knew. Happened in her class. One of the students wrote down, it went, quote, "The stars are so big, the moon is so small, stay as you are. The plangent cry for permanence and stability."
Yep.
This is Rachel Carson's book. I forget what it was titled, but she started the ecological movement. Do you know Rachel Carson's book?
No.
Okay. A writer in the early 60s, I think. Okay. That starts. Hey, that's very noisy. "The stars are so big, the moon is so small, stay as you are." He says that, whether verbalized or not, is the message and the logic, not of the mechanical. Oh, there's the use of logic. Logic in this sense means the effect, not left hemisphere reasoning. So that's how the Renaissance humanists neglected logic. That would be neglected the printing press's effect. So I might have to read that sentence we did a while ago differently. Because here's the message and the logic. That's comprehensive logic. That's fuzzy logic. Not of the mechanical age, but of the electronic age, in which we stand as the primitives of an undeveloped and unknown culture. He's starting to talk like the last line in Laws of Media, where we're entering uncharted territory.
Yep, so he's taken everybody through familiar territory, he's got them feeling at home, and now he's just starting to pull the rug.
Yeah, you liberal, you know, one out of ten of you guys might get a job in the ivory tower, but the rest of us are into a whole new space landscape.
Yeah, so it's a formulaic article in that sort of sense. Like, make a joke, parody myself, make you feel at home, start to point out what you've ignored, and then now he's going to just start cutting.
Now the lizard tongue flips out.
Yeah.
You know what I mean by that?
Yeah,
suddenly
yeah.
They see this lizard tongue come out of McLuhan. He's an alien. And then he backs off. In the next paragraph, I say this without enthusiasm. He backs off like pretending he's human.
I'm still one of you guys.
Yeah. This is good, Andrew. We're getting into the rhythms of this. I remember Human Kenner. Yeah, Hugh Kenner.
Because that's right, because he never made the leap out of that literary criticism world.
That's right. McLuhan used to be pissed off at him because he remained human. Human Kenner. A new inside joke here at Dobstown. Hugh Kenner, what? What did he say? Damn, I forgot what I was... why would I cite Human Kenner? Don't know. I have to come back. But I like that remember he said that every sense had its own rationality. That's what he means by logic. The rationality of each sense and the space it creates, and then the extensions and the logic, they require new ways of thinking. What was it? Hugh Kenner. Anyways, that, whether verbalized or not, is the message. That means the effect. The kid, he's not supporting the sentiment. He's saying this is the damaged condition that the electric environment puts the young child into, right?
Yeah.
Trying to get the world to stay as you are.
So logic in that sense is used in the sense of connected pattern or the workings out of once that essential images or transformation has been set in place.
It's a subliminal seduction.
Yeah.
He's saying that the logic is the attitudes that new media invoke in you. So the logic is the kind, you know, the pattern, the thinking you do under the seduction of the new environment. You have a knee-jerk response. So logic can, if you have people, remember, what's his name? Franian Zooey, J.D. Salinger is writing books, Catcher's Rye, that are appealing to people getting a little irritated with logic and left hemisphere thinking. And J.D. Salinger suggests, I think in Franian Zooey, that book, that logic was the apple, the evil apple that Eve ate. The point is that McLuhan is putting on the word logic and knowing that people are ambivalent about that concept of logic. So he's making it, in effect, a knee-jerk kind of thinking. Those of us, he says, who have had special regard for the ancient disciplines that passed out of our schools years ago. That was when he talked about the removal of Latin and that from schools. He considered that a conspiracy, I think he wrote in the 40s. We'll see them return and flourish as never before. Now, that's not really what's happening. He's telling the humanists that there will be a simulation. This is on the borderline of the beginning of the Android meme, Andrew. Android meme begins in 1960, according to my chart. He's responding to it. And he's not telling them that the Android meme will retrieve these ancient disciplines, the afterimage of them. The grammar and rhetoric will come back. I bet this is what Eric's book, Media and Formal Cause, is about. You know, I bought that book.
Mm-hmm.
There's a bunch of old articles.
Yeah, it's three old articles.
Wow, it's like really, what do you call it? Little effort went into that. Now, I haven't read the essay by Eric, but why retrieve these articles? They're good articles, but I've had them for 25, 30 years. It's really retro. Now, maybe his essay. Eric is capable of pretty interesting patterns in his writing when given a chance to write something on his own, you know. He'll talk about interesting pop culture patterns. But so maybe that is in his essay. Have you read his essay?
Yeah.
Is it the kind of stuff he did at Bologna?
I'd rather talk about that at another time. It was some, okay. I was a little like, in one sense, I enjoyed the book. You know, it had some really nice essays in it. It was nice to read again, but I don't feel it actually contributed or advanced or actually was anywhere as near as exciting as could have been.
Right. Okay. So, I mean, Eric's talking. I just remember he's producing a bunch of books. I think Andrew says in one of the early columns, "Well, the books are just collections of old articles."
Yeah. No, I think he'll have some new stuff. I'm hoping he's got some new stuff.
Okay. So he's talking about the retrieval of rhetoric and grammar. We talked about this on the MUM seminar today. How McClune predicted rhetoric would come back. So he's saying stuff that he said 10 years earlier, okay, to this group.
Yep, you're all going to become communications departments.
Yeah, you're going to be studying the effects of meetings on meetings.
Yep.
The generations immediately ahead of us will scorn the recent decades, and even centuries, as periods of triviality, frivolity, and of planned obsolescence. That's a great. He's starting to talk about the devastating changes, the apocalyptic.
Yeah, and this touches on also where he's talking about planned obsolescence. You know, is maybe he did underestimate actually how long planned obsolescence was going to stay around for.
Yeah, yeah. What I was getting at earlier. Okay, yeah. Looking at it that way, planned obsolescence means that it's planned to be obsolete. He's suggesting that the whole literate Illuminati that ran the Gutenberg galaxy were planning on dumping it at some point. See, that's loaded. The generations immediately ahead of us will scorn the recent decades and even centuries as periods of triviality, frivolity, and of planned obsolescence. Now, planned obsolescence can mean not careful tetrad management. It can just mean, well, people will use it for a couple of years and they'll throw it away. It's more like the throwaway society. So, and the surface interpretation of planned obsolescence is that, well, this whole Gutenberg galaxy is garbage. It's obsolete. Planned. It wasn't meant to be around.
Yes.
There's that surface meaning. But tetrad management anticipates obsolescence. Okay, we shall see all communities as well. As all commodities, as well as all commodities and dwellings, assume a stubborn depth character of organic persistence. So he's saying the human being will become a stubborn, the chemical body will become a fascist of maintaining its image of form. Is that what he means?
Stuff will stick around, I guess, on the surface level. I guess it's the birth of locality, the rebirth of localism and community. It's that early onset as well.
And of tourism, cultural tourism.
Yep, and it's also, I guess, on another level, he's just talked about planned obsolescence, so he's just flipped into talking about retrieval.
Yeah, 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 that's right. We shall see all communities as well as all commodities and dwellings, all chemical body things.
It's so lovely. Communities, commodities, dwellings, he just chucks them all in together.
The whole human enterprise.
Humus, stubborn humans.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They will continue to live in houses and eat food out of stubborn resistance. This is getting at what I was saying earlier today. He's trying to map out the new discarnate being.
Yeah.
You know, there was another, okay. What was it? Not sure. Yeah, because remember, in 1951, he recognizes the fusion, the cyborgian. It's now been 10 years or 200 years or 1,000 years of cyborgianism. He's moving beyond it. He's talking way beyond. See, William Burroughs is writing around this time about like alien forces or corporate elites coming and zapping. He made a movie around that time, having these corporate executives just sitting there at their desk at the corporate table, and then these beams come in and zap them and disappear them. And then these kind of aliens take over. That is a 19th century version of what's being zapped on the level McLuhan's talking about. I mean, he's talking chemical body. He's disappearing. But look at that. Now, you can see people read this. Depth character of organic persistence. They would think, oh, that's good. We're going organic. You know, this is the whole countercultural holistic movement he's predicting. Right? For the
Totally.
Cleaning up the chemical body. We shall see all communities, as well as all commodities, everything you sell, and all dwellings assume a stubborn depth character of organic persistence. See, depth criticism is a knee-jerk reaction. You get hyper-involved. It's like participant observation that Yana was talking about, the phrase that Malinowski came up with. Depth character of the organic body is not as up to date as the surface life of the chip body and the TV landscape, which later became the surface aesthetic of postmodernism, right? So he's actually talking about the postmodern aesthetic 10 years before it showed up. Mm-hmm. You get what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Okay, depth character of organic persistence, as if built by Frank Lloyd Wright. Survey programs will disappear from the curricula of studies as the panic. Ooh, there's Croker's panic. As the panic for permanence drives us into ever greater depth understanding of all kinds of knowledge and action. That means more and more committee meetings studying the 10 points of art life that you read earlier today. See? You take the 10-point program you said that art would go into in the late 40s, and you substitute committee meetings or texting in there, you come up with this sentence. Hey, this is very resonant with what we turn to probe and prepare for tonight's enemy session in the MUM survey. Look, he's saying that depth understanding is a knee-jerk reaction.
Yeah.
Endless fetishing and going and analyzing everything in depth. Like, we must study the effects of everything. He's predicting everybody becoming media ecologists and getting fanatic about studying the implications of everything.
Yeah, excuse my underwhelmness, Bob, but like you've anticipated yourself, I think, at least 1,000 times before now. And so it's,
what do you mean by that?
It's miraculous that you've done it again, but but miracles happen here all the time.
In other words, you remember this happening before. You're just amazed it happened again.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, this is tell all the participants of that they were just rehearsing what the great enemy session. This is incredible. Survey programs, that means like the encyclopedic view of across just the student learns all kinds of different topics, right? Subjects.
Yep.
There won't even be time to survey from the bird's eye view of the range of history, math, geography, literature, you know, the usual range. Everybody will become obsessive depth people, and that's why most of education by the 80s becomes bird courses, where people study, I don't know, what is the crazy titles. They don't teach, by the 80s and 90s, they don't teach subjects anymore. The students would, I don't know, they'd study Hollywood or something, or they would study...
Yeah, a single theme or a single book or something something.
Yeah, you probably went through some of it.
Yeah, I never had an education, Bob, so I was a full product of this.
Yeah, he's predicting what will be seen, what will actually be not education, will be seen as a great evolution into deeper perception of things. But it'll be the neurosis. It'll be OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, for Gutenberg topics. But and they'll go over and over again, like a committee meeting, and think they're exploring it in depth. But they'll still be stuck in the chemical body's speech dynamic. They'll become an oral culture as a knee-jerk reaction. Not deal with the digital tactility. Then he's gone pretty far in that. Let's say that takes about 2 minutes to say that part, right?
Yep.
He spoke for 2 minutes, and people are starting to get intimidated and panics. He says,
I say this without enthusiasm.
you did not see the lizard tongue come out. There was no lizard tongue. He says, it is not exhilarating to perceive the inexorable erasure of everything you are. It is not exhilarating to perceive the inexorable discovery of one's own childish ways of thought. The obsolescence of your chemical body brain. Many a teenager today, in his passionate pursuit of a crash program in adulthood, that actually is a pun on kids, you know, crashing their cars, right?
Yeah, it's also more Croker-esque terminology creeping in there with paralleling the panic.
That's right. Croker replayed. Well, Croker was the Android meme replay of this part of McLuhan. Remember my chart. I've got paranoia, schizophrenia, hysteria, panic, and ecstasy. They're all replayed by the Android meme. Actually, McLuhan is a replay of schizophrenia for the Android meme in the late 60s.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And the conspiracy mongers are a replay of paranoia. Croker's a replay of panic. Don't know if Croker fully understands his own simulation. He might. He might understand that his panic was not as critiquing as he thought it was.
It's not usually a question you can ask somebody in a friendly way, Bob, normally.
I know. It's tough to... that's why we call this enemy. We're just nice people. We are not enemies with enthusiasm. We are forced to be enemies by the neocons of around us. I am not an enemy with enthusiasm. Okay, so many a teenager today in his passionate pursuit of a crash program in adulthood looks on parent and teacher alike as superficial and banal in their modes of routinized living. Now, this is actually some of the script that was on the TV show in 1960 when they made fun, they reversed the Lolita dynamic. So when he went on TV, he'd dump it all out. When he got the opportunity to get into a live medium, he'd lay it all out. And to the point that a year and a half later, he's just beginning to say it to the humanists. You know, it's been, they don't know that they were getting old material.
Yeah.
The situation is the same on the non-personal level. We are all familiar with the computation based on a survey of present-day scientific development. We are all familiar. Who? That of all the greatest scientists who have ever lived, 95% are living right now. I don't think anybody was familiar with that at the time.
I think that comes out of... is that Bucky Fuller or Drucker? It's got to be one of those two, I would have thought.
I actually never knew where it came from. And when you asked me right now, I think I saw recently someone... He quoted somebody, and it wasn't Drucker or Fuller, but it could be. Right now, as you say that, I remember just recently seeing its source.
Bob, are you still there? We've got a drop, so we'll resume shortly. Okay, we're back. Bob just dropped out briefly, so we're just resuming again. Where Bob's talking about, he's just remembered seeing the source of the, about the 95% of scientists living right now.
Yeah, when you say Fuller, Bucky, or Drucker, I remember just recently seeing that fact and for the first time hearing the source. But I don't know if that's an illusion, deja vu, or what. So I'll rest it. I'll rest with the fact it's Drucker or Fuller. I think it's something that Drucker would say. But the important thing is that McLuhan goes on to say, does this mean that there is more human intelligence now than before? Not at all. It means that, I will add, it means that science is obsolete, right? And so there's more of these obsolete characters. And he does not say not at, he goes, not at all, and then say what it is. He goes, but, he shifts a little bit. He does not consider, he does not go into saying you've been scrubbed off the decks of the laser beam. Remember that quote, 1968?
Yeah.
Like, you know, the adult imagination, the human imagination scraped off the decks. That's what he could say. He goes into a surface optimism. But it does mean that we've hit upon some means of activating intelligence that is new. Now, what is that activation? Turns out to be pop culture. The counterculture, rock and roll. Amateurs, every amateur gets into the fray because the media needs content. We've activated intelligence in a new way. But he's not going to go into those details with this audience. A.N. Whitehead pointed to the discovery of the 19th century as the discovery of the technique of invention. Bertrand Russell pointed to the great achievement of the 20th century as the technique of suspended judgment, which is maybe Malinowski's participant observation. Is it the management of the ivory tower by hardware technocrats, or what I call tetrad management? That is the discovery of the process of insight itself, the technique of avoiding the automatic closure or involuntary fixing of attitudes that so easily results from any given cultural situation. So he's saying the discovery that the medium is the message. That's what he's saying. The technique of the suspended judgment is the discovery of what causes knee-jerk attitudes, like we were talking about a little while ago earlier in the article, right?
Yeah.
He could say from any given medium or any given technological situation. But since the technique of suspended judgment is discovered in the 20th century, he's saying that satellite or radio or television created the technique of suspended judgment. Just like he said earlier, radio created the depth criticism. He's trying to point out that noticing that the creative process is programmed in any culture, that is a possibility only in satellite conditions. See, the very people hearing this would be blown away by the statement. Well, that's quite an amazing pattern. The discovery of the process of insight itself, in other words, the logic of the chemical human being's brain, is now the content of a programming.
Yeah. So in a certain sense, already we're seeing the obsolescence of tetrads and the left and right hemisphere of the brain.
Proving we're moving into the pentadic.
Yeah.
Now, that's what's really, he's going to do a lot of leaping about to point to the pentadic, because he has to deal with an audience that's just going to be impressed with the tetradic. No, it's pretty hard to get. See, that's why he left the university on a certain level and went pop culture. And it shocked his colleagues that he dared to go on TV and talk about Telstar and Cape Canaveral. Remember, the objection to this guy is he left the ivory tower. Well, it was a radical move, but it could be because he saw the pentadic coming. It didn't matter that he left. As a chemical body.
Yeah, I guess the meaning of that is yet to stabilize, so you know, we'll still see.
Well, that's a clever way to say that. And the meaning of that is yet to stabilize, Bob. your paramediacology and its meaning has not been stabilized, Bob. Well, that's a good put down. What a put down.
It's not a put down, Bob. It's just I'll think it was a nice way of saying, I'll think about that, Bob.
Have you ever said those words before? Is that what they say in university now? Your ideas have not stabilized for me.
No. I don't know how that came into my mind, but that was the phrase.
Okay. The technique of open field perception.
See, maybe that's what I was mirroring. This, I wasn't prepared to. I wanted to have a suspended judgment, Bob.
Yeah, I thought for a minute that you needed to get to stabilization, but it doesn't mean that you will or want to get to stabilize. But you did use it as a critique of me.
No, not a critique, merely just to emphasize a distance or space, as in there's something in that to digest, which is not immediately apparent to me.
Okay, all right, so I took it personally. Big mistake. What does he say a little earlier? This is not... Just a second... The situation is the same on the non-personal level. The non-personal. And then he goes into the pentadic, or the non-human. Okay, both the discovery of the method of invention and the discovery of the technique of insight. See, this is the only place I heard, ever saw him spell out in other terms what the technique of suspended judgment is. That's what was really valuable about this article. See, he's putting in the technique of insight, because he used to say that young people are interested in insights, as if he was not interested in insights, he was interested in what caused people to think they had made insights.
Yeah.
So he's now saying that the discovery of the technique of suspended judgment is a technique of insight, and that this not only concerns scientists, but humanists, and have been freely used by both of what C.P. Snow calls two cultures. So he's saying that humanists and scientists both use the technique of insight and the method of invention. Actually, the technique of suspended judgment would be more favorable to the humanist view because the inventor makes things and then the humanist studies the effects, right? So I don't know if you can say the technique of suspended judgment is being used by scientists. Maybe the theoretical scientists, but not so much maybe the actual gadget makers.
Well, insofar as they are aware that they're the tools and techniques of observation are shaping what they're looking at, yeah, that applies, I would have thought.
And also maybe when you're getting into atomic bombs and that level of technology, it caused a bit of detachment in the scientists that wasn't there before World War II. What's his name? The famous Oppenheimer was the figure of that. McLuhan uses a few quotes from him. Okay.
That hesitancy I guess that was sort of some of the first moments where you get that a slight humility entering into the scientific community.
Yeah, the shock that they may not be bringing forth a world of progress that they thought they were working towards. Okay, both the discovery of the method of invention and the discovery of the technique of insight not only concern scientists but humanists. Now, here's what's interesting. He's talking technically to these humanists, and they probably want to hear about Ulysses and poetry. And so he's pointing out that the humanists have to start looking at technique, not just sensibility.
Mm-hmm.
And the two methods have been freely used by both of what C.P. Snow, I said C.P. Lewis earlier, it's C.P. Snow, calls the two cultures. So much so indeed that the resonant statistic about 95% of the greatest scientists of human history now being alive may equally apply to poets, painters, and philosophers. Wow, that's a great culture's our business. That's the Canada Council grants economy.
Yeah, I just love how he just slots in things like resonant statistic. Like he's talking about number in like Pythagorean terms. He's saying it like, oh, 9, that's a spirit number. 5, oh, that's rhetoric. 95, that's a lovely resonant statistic there.
Well, no, he does talk about that in Understanding Media about the use of the number 7. And the repeating of 7 is a resonant icon.
Yeah, we've talked about 9, wearing number 9 in the Yankee hats. Yeah,
it's wearing number 95. You're right. That's humorous. The resonant statistic. What a beautiful number. And but he's saying that he's proving what I interpret my interpretation that they're obsolete is what he means by great. There's more and more of something in numbers. As a matter of fact, in the dialogue of Muggeridge, Mailer, McLuhan, and maybe Robert Fulford, that was transcribed in The Realist by Paul Krasner and was available in the CBC archives, in that, McLuhan says, it's the greatest time in human history. And Mailer or Muggeridge says, you mean in terms of numbers? And McLuhan says, yes. That's what that meant. Numbers. It's obsolete. More and more people can engage in science and in the arts because, like Lewis said, they ain't where the action is anymore. So spread. It's like they gave education, literate education, to the poor people, the working classes, in the period before World War II. In the period after World War II, they gave the right to be a great scientist and a great artist to the working class. You get that?
Yep.
Okay, he says, perhaps we in this group, he tries to create group dynamic, mm-hmm. buttress, perhaps we in this group ought really to ask ourselves why we tend instinctively to reject the idea that we might be living in the greatest of all intellectual and artistic periods, even though we may endorse the ebullient scientific estimate of our time. So you say, yes, 95% of the greatest scientists live today, but that would be an identity crisis, and people instinctively reject that this is the greatest of all intellectual and artistic periods because it's not. It's the electronic abundance of pop culture that's new, and that threatens the literary.
Yeah, you've also got that the good news, bad news dynamic, Bob, insofar as he often talks about that, you know, humanism is built upon the ruins because they see the potentiality in things. So yeah. Announcing that things are the greatest times and all is pretty bad news for a humanist in some respects.
that's true. It's pointing out the obsolescence.
Yeah, there is no more potential because it's all locked down.
Right. And in it may be the last interview we have from McLuhan in 79, just before his stroke, he is interviewed with somebody. We don't know who it is. And that's the one where he talks about Kissinger as the kiss of death. And he talks about corporate stuff. But he always refers back to his interest in romanticism and the romantic period. He talks about how expert he is in that. And he talks about how he's all about suffering, not trying to be happy. And he talks about the meme of ruins that he's going to see in the next sentence, going to say. The ruins dynamic that motivates the humanist. He talks about that at the very end of his life, though I guess he didn't know it. But it shows that these themes of the early media ecologist can be part of the later media ecologist.
Mm.
Especially when you're talking to obsolete humanists. So he says, at any period of the past, humanists have been distinguished by a love of ruins and by a gloomy sense that change and decay invest the scene. Perhaps Lord Macaulay hit upon a new strategy. Convinced that he did live in the greatest of all human centuries, he compensated for his non-humanist buoyancy by giving us the memorable image of Andrew Crystal, of the New Zealander. Now, this is interesting, right? You know the Finnings Wake has New Zealand is at the end of Finnings Wake?
Oh, I know there's some reference to a haka and a few other things in there. There's some references, but I didn't know at where it fits in the whole schema of things.
Is there a New Ireland down there?
You could probably argue that parts of Australia were... could be referred to as a New Ireland.
Yeah, but I think there's an island called New Ireland, though I'm not sure. But Joyce might have been just thinking of the other Ireland. This Ireland in the South Pacific that mirrored the Ireland of the North. That may be what the symmetry I'm thinking of, rather than New Zealand. But that area of the world comes in at some
point. Yeah, well, I guess New Ireland is also... considered part of Papua New Guinea.
Yeah, that's where my mind is on the map.
Yep.
Okay, so he said, Lord Macaulay, convinced that he did live in the greatest of all human centuries, compensated for his non-humanist buoyancy, that would be not engaged with ruins, by giving us the memorable image of the New Zealander who would one day arrive to sit upon a fragment of London Bridge in order to sketch the ruins of St. Paul's. Petrarch, in a famous passage which has often been misread as a glorious prophecy of the great Renaissance so near to him, actually stood amidst the ruins of Rome and stated that just as surely as there had been uninterrupted decline from Augustan days to his own time, so in the years that lay ahead there would be continuous decay of such classical treasures and skills as still remain. Gibbon was faithful to the same perspective when he tells in his autobiography how, quote,
I was in Rome on the 15th of October, 1764, as I sat musing amidst the ruins of the capital, while the barefooted friars were singing vespers in the Temple of Jupiter, that the idea of writing the decline and fall of the city first started to my mind.
Yeah, the idea of writing the decline and fall of the city of Rome first started to my mind. What's the Eliot line? Fragments of my ruins I've shored up. I've shored up against the fragments of my ruins.
Yep.
Okay, well, I'm ruined. I am had enough of this, Andrew. I'm just going to stop.
Okay, so let's pause midway. I think we've done some good reading, Bob.
Yeah, don't end right yet. There's a couple of points here. I'm coming to the end, but this the image of the New Zealander who would one day arrive to sit upon a fragment of London Bridge in order to sketch the ruins of St. Paul's. He compensated for his... He wasn't just a ruinist, he's saying, Lord Macaulay. But he was aware of the ruinous meme, or the ruinous threat or the ruinous tendency, right? Because he was buoyant, but he was aware the ruinous was the humanist. I guess that's what he's pointing out. Convinced he did live in the greatest of all human centuries, in other words, he was buoyant about it, he still gave the, he still was aware of the ruins. But wouldn't that be the ruins? I think Marshall says the creative process is goes into the garbage to create new objects. When you see the ruins about you, that's when the creative impulse creates something new, perhaps.
There's a lot of different ways of reading that. I mean, and one of the other ways is he holds out the possibility that it's all going to collapse to the point where a dirty colonial is going to turn up in the great seat of empire and overlook its treasures laid to waste.
Right, it's looking at the old stuff, is what you're saying.
Yeah, well, it's in that sort of sense, he's holding out the possibility that, yep, there's going to be ruins again shortly.
Right, and I guess the guy is missing the London Bridge he's sitting on. The London Bridge may represent new technology.
Sit upon the fragment of London Bridge, so the London Bridge has fallen to pieces.
Right, and he actually says in War and Peace and Global Village a few years later that it was sold and sent off to Texas or someplace. Remember that? He said, no, he projected that may happen someday. Okay, so what I see here is he knows that the effect of what he's saying will put these humanists into looking at all their enterprises as ruins. He's actually going, he says, I've just ruined your whole world by telling you what ruination is coming to your enterprises. The young kids will think that you're fossils and routinized robots. He said, don't worry, that's your tradition anyways, to regard the world as ruin. Or to look at the continuous decay of old artifacts. So it's a great joke on the humanists to show that the whole planet and the chemical body is ruined by the new discarnate state and then make a value out of it.
Yeah, I was quite struck, I guess, as we went through it really slowly, just hit by, there is the sense of the Joyce, and he's hauling through the cycles as well. And so he's sort of, you get a sense of McLuhan having pulled back and saying that there was ruins, we're in a great time, there could be ruins in the future. So he's standing in a certain sense divorced from time and looking at these massive cycles of human history.
Yeah. And that is the view from the satellite. He's looking at the whole planet and its cultural cycles.
Yeah, well, it's not just the satellite per se, which sort of looks at the all world all at once, but it's incorporating the time dimension, and so in that sense, possibly going beyond satellite vision.
Yeah, the famous picture that Stuart Brand made famous in the Whole Earth Catalog in 69, the view from the astronauts of the blue pearl of the earth, you know, that famous image, and it made people think the world was unified. What is left out of that picture is the technical apparatus, the satellite, that's gone around that thing and made it a ruin.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, that's probably what that's what Brand's really expressing. The stars are so big, the moon is so small, stay as you are. That's actually the real meaning of that image from the spaceship.
That's a good place to stop, Bob.
Yeah. Okay, that's a new insight.
Yeah, thank you very much. I'll just press stop now and we'll just have a quick chat afterwards. Cheers.